चैतन्य प्रभु नित्यानंद श्री अद्वैत गदाधर श्री गौर भक्तवृंद की जय। श्री श्री राधे कृष्ण कौ कबीर श्याम कुंड राधे खुद गिरी गोवर्धन की जय। श्री वृंदावन धाम की जय। नवदत्त धाम की जय। गंग जमुना तुलसी भक्ति देवी की जय। आनंद कोटि वैष्णव वृंद की जय। समवेत भक्त वृंद की जय। गौ प्रेमानंदी और गौर से सम्बोधवतीस All glory to some of the devotees, all glory to some of the devotees, all glory to Sri Guru and Sri Guranga, all glory to Sri Prabhupada. Namo Vishnu Padaya Krishna Prashtaya Bhutale Srimate Bhaktivedanta Swami Nityanamine Namaste Saraswata Devi Gauravani Prachadane Nirvishesha Shunyavadi Pashachadesha Tarane Sri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Sri Advaita Gadadhar Shivasri Gauravakta Rinda Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. So this is a presentation of Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu, a work written by Srila Jiva Goswami. It's one of the principal works of the Gaudiya Sampradaya, and Rupa Goswami is called the Rasacharya, the acharya whose contribution was explanation of rasa. Though the word rasa is found in the Upanishads, not too many sampradayas have concentrated on explaining about rasa. But in our sampradaya, the concept of rasa has become quite prominent, and therefore Rupa Goswami has produced a whole book, actually two books, to explain the concepts of rasa and how it relates to Krishna. So this is the first book, which covers all the rasas and sadhana, bhava, and prema. And there's another book called Ujjwala Nilamani, which expands on Madhurya rasa and goes through the same procedure of analyzing in the same way as he's done in Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu. In Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu, he does explain Madhurya rasa, but he does it very briefly, more briefly than, let's say, Shanta rasa or Dasi or Sakya or Vatsalya. Makes a quite brief explanation of Madhurya rasa, but then he expands that into a whole book in Ujjwala Nilamani. So anyway, the work is about rasa. The title, Sindhu, means an ocean, and Amrita means, of course, very sweet nectar. Rasa, of course, is the main subject matter, so it's the nectar of rasa, which is the ocean of very sweet rasa. But this rasa is bhakti rasa, to distinguish it from material rasa. So we have rasa in the material world. Rasa literally means taste. But that in Sanskrit literature, they have a concept of rasa, which is material, which is used, the theory of rasa is used in to explain how to develop a drama or a play. A play involves people, but then to create some excitement, you have to have relationships between the people, and that develops into a story, etc. But a story is not complete without the feelings of the people for one another being developed. And that makes a good play, where you can identify with the different characters and their emotions in relation to other people. So the concept of material rasa is there to explain the various relationships that people have in dramas, but then dramas also relate to material life. So we'll portray material life through a drama, and we'll try to explain the relationships in terms of rasa. So that there's a material rasa there, between man and women, and man and man, and men and children, etc. So this is bhakti rasa, this is spiritual rasa, in relation only to Krishna, not in terms of material persons. So it is an ocean of sweet rasa in relation to the spiritual world and Krishna, not to any material concept of rasa. Oops. Okay, so the work is divided into four parts. Just like in ancient times, they would draw maps, and we have big oceans in between the continents, and then they would say, this is the eastern part of the ocean, this is the western part of the ocean, this is the northern part, and this is the southern part. So we have an ocean, that's the Sindhu of Bhakti Rasa. And so he's divided it up into four parts. So first is the eastern section. We can say the first book. Yeah? Then there's a second book called the southern portion of the ocean. Then there's a third part called the western portion. And then there's a fourth part called the northern portion of the book. So there's four parts to the Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu. So the work is actually divided quite systematically. The first part, we can say, is introductory, and it deals with the first, we can say, it's got divided into different chapters. So here we have our ocean, and then we have our types here. So the eastern section, which is what we normally study in Bhakti Shastri, etc. And we have the southern section, which deals with rasa and the five ingredients of rasa. And then we have the western section, which deals with the primary rasas like Sakya and Vatsalya and Madhurya. And then we have the northern section, which deals with seven secondary rasas like comedy and anger and fear. So we got four broad parts of this work. So the eastern section is also quite systematically developed. It has, just like the ocean, it has waves in it. So the eastern section of the ocean has four waves. So the first one is the introductory wave. The second part is sadhana. Third part is bhava. And the fourth part is prema. So it explains all these different types of bhakti plus the introduction. So that makes three types of bhakti: sadhana, bhava, prema, plus introductory part. So today I cover the introductory wave, or the introductory chapter. So the work begins with some introductory verses, like most Sanskrit works, the introduction generally it invokes auspiciousness. So that's what we call the Mangalacharana, the invoking of or prayers for auspiciousness. So each work will invoke prayers in different ways. This particular work starts out with a glorification of Krishna. That's the invocation, basically, by glorifying Krishna. But it summarizes the whole of this work, and it also summarizes, we can say, the whole of our philosophy also. So the first line, Akila Rasamrita Murti, this means, Murti means the form, Akila means all. Rasamrita is like in the title, sweet rasa. So he's the form of all sweet rasas, all spiritual sweet rasas. And Krishna is that very form. Other forms of the Lord also have sweet rasa, but they do not manifest to the same extent that Krishna manifests the rasa. So that's why we put Krishna in a very special category. So for instance, Ramchandra manifests rasa, but he does not manifest all the primary rasas in relation to his devotees. So of course we say Sita and Rama have Madhurya rasa, but nobody else has Madhurya rasa with Ramchandra, because he only has one wife. Sakya rasa also is absent, no friends. Vatsalya, his mother and father. Everybody else is Dasya rasa. And for Vishnu again, it is Dasya rasa. So they don't manifest all the rasas very fully. Krishna manifests everything fully. So that's why we put him in a special position as Swayam Bhagavan. So he manifests all rasas. That's all the primary rasas. Santa, Dasya, Sakya, Vatsalya, Madhurya. Plus all the secondary rasas like Hasya and Adbhuta and Virya and Krodha, anger, Baya, fear, Vibhatsa. Disgust. Right. So there's seven secondary rasas, five primary rasas, and Krishna displays these more fully than any other form of the Lord. So that's why it's called Akila Rasamrita Murti. So primarily this work is about Krishna when we talk about the Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu, the ocean of Bhakti Rasa, because Krishna manifests all of these rasas fully, therefore the book is about him mostly. Most of the examples are concerning Krishna. So, the first line describes Krishna being the Swayam Bhagavan, or the full form of Rasa. And then he's various phrases modify him. Prasurmara Ruchi Ruda. And Tarakapali Kalita and Shama Lalita and Radha Prayan Vidur Jayati. So Krishna is all victorious, and then he's described as the one who spreads out his ruchi, or his effulgence, everywhere. He controls Taraka and Pali, two gopis. He's embraced by Shama and Lalita, and he is the beloved of Radha. He's controlled by Radha. So this verse describes Krishna's relationship with various gopis. Though Krishna has manifest all rasas, Rupa Goswami has chosen Madhurya Rasa, because this is the most complete rasa. And then within that, he's described various relationships of Madhurya Rasa of various gopis. Like that. So we have various relationships of the gopis with Krishna. Now ultimately Radha is topmost, and that's why we have Radha and Krishna in our temples. So that's expressed in the last line here. Radha Prayam Vidu. Krishna is the beloved of Radha, and Radha controls Krishna, so she's at the top. But Radha has her group of gopis in the spiritual world. Like in Mayapur, we have the Astasakis, Lalita and Vishaka and other gopis. So they're her paksha, her group. That's her group. So they're right next to Radha. So they also have a very intimate relationship with Krishna, almost like Radha. On the very opposite side, we have the enemy group. That is Chandravali and her group. So they include Pali, Padma, and Saibhya. And if you read any of the pastimes of the gopis and Krishna, often will see Saibhya and Pali and Padma supporting Chandravali and insulting Radha. So they're the enemy group, or the Vipaksha. So they're most distantly separated. And then we have friends who support Radha's group. That is Shamala and others, the Sushit, or the friendly group. So they're quite nicely allied with the Krishna's, Radha's friends, like Lalita and Vishaka, and they help Radha and Krishna meet, and they try to thwart the attempts of Chandravali to meet Krishna. Then we have the Tathashta group, which means a neutral group, but they're not really neutral. They actually side with Chandravali, and they support her. So we have this group also, which is a little bit further distanced away. So in this way, we get all sorts of different types of gopis who are represented in this verse here. Taraka, Pali, Shama, Lalita, Radha, Prayan. So we get all these different groups of gopis with a more distant relationship and gradually more intimate relationship with Krishna displayed in this verse of Madhurya Rasa. There is, however, a double meaning, an intentional double meaning to the verse. So it is a comparison of the moon with the stars in the sky. So Vidu refers to Krishna, but it also refers to the moon. So it's a glorification of the moon in relation to the various groups of stars in the sky in the dark of the night, in the month of Vaishak, which is the spring season. So there's Vaishak is a particularly bright group of stars in the sky, and in Vaishak Nakshatra and the full moon, then we have the moon coming very close to that group of stars, and it looks very beautiful, the stars twinkling next to the moon, and the full moon in Vaishak month of the year. That is actually what is described there, the dark sky with the moon. So the full moon, which destroys suffering and creates happiness by its cooling rays, shines everywhere with its excellent qualities and beauty. It is the very form of nectar filled with all tastes. It eclipses the host of stars by its light, accepts the playful gestures of the night, and fondly enters the Vishaka constellation in the spring season. So that's the other meaning of the verse. So this actually supports the main meaning about Krishna, because Krishna is compared to the moon and the gopis are compared to the stars in the sky. So it emphasizes the beauty of the relationship between Krishna and the gopis. So Then Rupa Goswami has a few other verses. In one verse, he compares the devotees to makara, which we sometimes say are sharks. But sharks are not very nice fish, or not even fish, but generally we think of them as carnivorous, so we don't like them too much. So the makara is actually not a shark, it's a kind of a combination of various features of various things like an elephant trunk and bird's feet and a peacock tail, etc. But he swims in the water. He's considered to be the king of the fish. So this is a depiction of that makara. Krishna has makara earrings also, so you often see the earrings are like that, like a little elephant snout on the fish. So it's not a real shark. So the king of the fish, they play joyfully in the ocean, and of course this is the Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu. So the devotees are able to dive deep into this ocean of Bhakti Rasa. And they can also avoid the nets. The fishermen throw out nets to try to catch fish. But the makaras, because they're the king of the ocean, they can dive very deeply and they avoid the nets. So the nets are the nets of karma and material life. And the makara also avoid swimming up the rivers. So some fish like to go up the rivers also, but these makara, they like to swim deeply in the ocean of rasa and they avoid the rivers. What are the rivers? The rivers are the five types of liberation. That is suyuja, merging in the Supreme Lord, getting a form like the Lord, sarupya, going to the same planet as the Lord, salokya, getting powers like the Lord, shashti, like that, and even being near the Lord, samipya. These are considered types of liberation. So the devotees even avoid these things. They're not interested in these things. They only want to enjoy within the ocean of rasa by serving Krishna in pure prema. Oh, there's a makara. Often depicted in temples in India and even this is Thailand, I think, like that. And Rupa Goswami also prays that the book will smother the tongues of the followers of Jnana and Karma, who are like volcanoes in the ocean. There's a mythical fire that spouts out of the ocean somewhere. So that's like the tongues of the followers of Jnana and Karma, because they will criticize rasa. Yeah? And they'll think it's material. The Jnanis don't like disturbance of emotion. We shouldn't have emotions. So rasa is emotion. Love affairs, no good. We have to reject them. So any talk of rasa, they'll say is material, and anything material is to be rejected. So they will criticize Krishna's rasa. The Karmis, of course, will also criticize rasa, because they'll see that Krishna has rasa, but then he does all sorts of things which are not according to dharma. He steals the gopis from the husbands and steals butter and yogurt and so many things. So those who are involved in karma like do everything very properly. When they see the Krishna doing his pastimes, they will criticize very heavily. So they also don't understand that he's actually on the spiritual level. So Rupa Goswami prays that this work will actually stop them from criticizing, because he'll present the rasa in such a way that we can understand that it's got nothing to do with the material world. So now we come to the very important verse of this work, which is also quoted in Bhagavad Gita and Chaitanya Charitamrita and in Bhagavatam. So this is one of the pivotal verses of our whole sampradaya. It's Anya Abhilashita Shunya Jnana Karma Dhyanavritam Anukulyan Krishna Nusiranam Bhakti Uttama. So Bhakti Uttama means highest bhakti or pure bhakti. So this is a general definition given. And then when Rupa Goswami discusses three types of bhakti, sadhana, bhava, and prema, this verse will apply to all those types of bhakti. So it's a general definition. And any other type of bhakti which is not uttama bhakti will not give prema. It will not give the nectar of devotion, bhakti rasa rindu sindhu. You cannot enter the ocean of bhakti rasa if you do any other type of bhakti. You can get liberation, you can go to the spiritual world, but you won't get that rasa. So that's why this definition is important. If we follow this, then we get that goal. If we don't follow it, we get something else. So therefore, this is a very important verse. So the highest bhakti is defined as continuous service or emotions directed towards Krishna. That's Krishna Anusilanam. Anusilanam means to cultivate a relationship. So we cultivate a relationship not with any material person, but with the Supreme Lord, particularly Krishna. Right. So it is continuous service. Anu means in this sense continuous. So continuous service. But then we have emotions also which are included within this. So it's not just action. It's also your love for Krishna itself. The emotional aspect is part of the anusilanam. So we have two aspects of anusilanam. His expanded, for it's not just Krishna, any other authorized form of the Lord can be the object of your devotion, like Narasimhadeva or Rama. And it's also called, it can be pure bhakti also. So Krishna, his expansion forms or others, related to even the devotees. We can have bhakti for the devotees also, like Hanuman or whatever. And it's also considered uttama bhakti. And it should be a pleasing attitude towards him, anukulyena. We should do it favorably for Krishna, in other words, affectionately, not out of hatred, with an attempt to try to please him. That is anukulyena. Anukulyena Krishna, anusilanam. Okay. So as I mentioned, that anusilanam or cultivation can take the active form of service, such as cooking for Krishna, making garlands for Krishna, doing aarti for Krishna, dressing Krishna, etc. These are active services. But even chanting the name of Krishna is service. Seva, chesha rupa bhakti. Chesha means action, so it's active bhakti. We use our senses and our in service of the Lord. The other is the emotional aspect of anusilanam or cultivation. So this is called bhava rupa bhakti. Bhava means emotions. So this actually doesn't manifest so well in sadhana, but when we get to the next station, level, that's called bhava bhakti. So that actually is the bhava here, bhava rupa bhakti. That's bhava, the stage of bhava, where we can perceive Krishna and we've developed a relationship with him, which may be shanta, dasya, sakya, vatsalya, madhurya. So that's the emotional aspect there, the relationship with Krishna in different ways. So this is kind of a little dormant in the beginning of devotional service, and we concentrate on the chesha rupa bhakti, the active one, hearing, chanting, remembering, deity worship, etc. But gradually that the emotions begin to develop and our relationship with Krishna begins to become more and more prominent until we get bhava bhakti. So these are the two aspects of anusilanam. So as I said, it could be Krishna or any expansion, all the different forms of the Lord, bona fide forms, you can have bhakti for them. And we can consider this uttama bhakti also. So it's not just Krishna, with a pleasing attitude towards him. So there is a little bit of a discussion. What does pleasing mean? Does it mean that Krishna is pleased? Here we have Nrisimhadeva tearing apart Hiranyakasipu. We know that's not bhakti. Hiranyakasipu is not a devotee. But it's very pleasing for Nrisimhadeva. He likes to do this, tear apart Hiranyakasipu. So we can't say that bhakti means pleasing, the Lord is pleased. It doesn't always mean that, because here the Lord is pleased, but he's killing a demon. So that cannot be part of bhakti at all. Then if we think very carefully, we have another type of thing. Have an example of the Lord being displeased. If it's displeasing, it should not be bhakti also, and displeasing to the Lord. But then we have a case of Mother Yasoda. She takes the milk off the fire and Krishna gets displeased. And he kicks the pot of yogurt and it opens up, and then he runs out into the yard and he feeds butter to the monkeys. So Mother Yasoda's act of taking the milk off the fire is displeasing to Krishna. But is that bhakti or not? Yeah, it must be bhakti, because she's an interested devotee, and she's trying to do work for Krishna. But Krishna's displeased. So therefore, whether Krishna's pleased or displeased, that's not really the factor that makes it favorable bhakti or anukulyena Krishna anusilanam. So then we have to think very carefully, what does this unpleasing attitude towards him mean? But then we have another way of looking at it. We do our activity with the intention of pleasing Krishna. So then that fits for Mother Yasoda. She's always trying to please Krishna. And she takes the milk off the fire so it doesn't burn, so she can make some sweets for Krishna. So her intention is to please Krishna by doing that. He may be displeased and angry, but her intention is to please him. So that makes it uttama bhakti. Whereas Srinivasa Kasipu is not trying to please Nrisimhadeva at all, so therefore we can discard that as bhakti, even if Nrisimhadeva is very pleased to pull him apart and tear out his intestines. We don't consider this bhakti. So therefore the actual definition is, for anukulyena Krishna anusilanam, is cultivating a relationship with the Lord with the intention of pleasing him, whether he's pleased or not, or we intend to please him. In other words, we're doing it out of great affection. Now, the first line of this verse is Anya abhilashita shunya yana karma dhyanavartam. Anya abhilashita shunya. Shunya means absent, empty. As in sunyavadi, it's people who propound emptiness, that is nothingness, that is the Buddhists. So it should be devoid of other desires. So one desire is permitted, desire to please the Lord. Other desires should not be there. So we should not have desires for ourselves or desires for our friends. The only desire to please the Lord. And then the last part of that line is jnana karma adi anavritam. Anavritam means not covered up or not blocked by. So jnana and karma and other processes should not obstruct this bhakti in any way. Which means that we can do those activities as long as they don't create an obstacle to bhakti. An obstacle would mean that for instance, we may do karma yoga, but if we start worshipping devatas, then that's an obstacle to bhakti. Because we're trying to please somebody else besides Krishna. And the definition is anya abhilashita shunya. No other desire except the desire to please Krishna. No mention of devatas or anything there. So, therefore, we start worshipping devatas and karma yoga, then that's obstruction. And so we have to avoid that type. So, we can do karma yoga. We avoid the worship of devatas, but if we think that even these other activities of karma yoga, following our dharma, our occupational duties, following the other rituals for controlling the senses, if we think that those are necessary for bhakti, and if I don't do them, I'm very sinful, that also becomes an obstacle to bhakti, because bhakti is independent. So if we make bhakti dependent on karma, then also that's obstacle again. So we can't do it in that way. Same with jnana. If we can take some portions of jnana, such as Babaji say, live alone, so that living in alone all by oneself in one place and not speaking, that is one type of sadhana and jnana. So the devotee can adopt that to some extent. Do his nirjana bhajan somewhere in Radhakund, whatever. He could do that. But he should not introduce the other aspects of jnana, such as merging in Brahman, etc. Then it becomes very unfavorable. Just as by doing karma yoga, we introduce fulfilling our material desires. Then again, it's unfavorable. It's not pure bhakti anymore. So we can do elements of jnana or karma or some other process as long as they don't obstruct the bhakti, as long as bhakti does not become dependent on those processes, then we could do them. In any case, it has to be anya abhilashita shunya, devoid of other desires, only the desire to please the Lord. That is pure bhakti. So that type of pure bhakti, of course, it's not pure in the literal sense of the term, because we're doing sadhana, and we begin with a little bhakti and a lot of anartas. If we mix a little bit of the jnana or the karma into it, and we have a little bit of a desire for escaping from our miserable material position and getting peace and liberation, or if we mix it with the desire to get some material happiness or maybe get a little taste of Svargaloka on the way, etc., mix a little karma in it, the result is we can go to the spiritual world, and of course our material desires and anarshas are all destroyed when we do that, but we end up with jnana, we end up with a type of shantarasa, and with the karma mixed in, we can get salokya, sarupya, and sarsti. We can have a very nice body, in a very nice place, nice powers, and we have a nice palace, and we can meditate on Supreme Lord, but we don't serve Him too much. So the rasa is very, very dilute in either case, shantarasa or the relationship through mixing karma with the bhakti. So that is why we can't do that even in the sadhana. We have to avoid these mixtures and attempt pure bhakti. Then we get these, the bhakti rasamrita syndrome. So that is why this verse is very important to emphasize that point. So we may think, oh, we're not doing pure bhakti now because I do have so many material desires. Yes, we do have. But at least we do have also the understanding that when I am worshipping the Lord or chanting Hare Krishna, I'm not asking Krishna, please give me a new car, please give me some money, please give me a house. We're not asking things like that. We don't explicitly ask things when we're doing our bhakti. And we're trying to please the Lord by our activity. So yes, we're not completely pure. We still have anarthas, and we'll have anarthas until we go through Nishta, Ruchya, Sakti, up into Bhava, and even in Bhava we have anarthas. So we'll still have the anarthas, but they get less and less as we go on. At the same time, we're trying to get that perfect type of bhakti, which is Abhilashita Shunya. So that's the type of bhakti which will lead to this result of prema, and getting into the spiritual world and having full rasa with Krishna. So there are three types of uttama bhakti, or pure bhakti: sadhana, bhava, and prema. It's all one bhakti in one sense, but that's why I gave an example of a flower. The flower is in bud, the flower slightly blossoms, and then the flower is in full bloom. It's this same flower, but it's, let's say, manifesting its qualities more fully when we get to prema bhakti. So we start with the bud, that's the sadhana, and then gradually all the other elements of bhakti manifest, and the qualities and activities manifest purely. So we have three types of bhakti, which are all uttama bhakti. So, in relation to these stages, we also have the qualities which start manifesting. Two of the qualities will manifest in sadhana, two qualities manifest in bhava, two qualities manifest in prema. So we get six qualities. So these six qualities are special qualities, unique qualities of bhakti that distinguish it from karma, jnana, yoga, or any other process. Very unique. The first one is called kleshagni, which means destruction of klesha. Klesha means suffering. So bhakti destroys suffering. Other processes also destroy suffering. Karma yoga, we do some prayaschittas, atonements, etc. We counteract our sins so we can get a little relief. In that sense, there's a destruction of suffering. Ultimately, we create punya and we don't escape the material world. So it's not a real destruction of karmas completely. Jnana yoga and astanga yoga, if you perform them properly, ultimately you can get destruction of all your karmas and consequently all of your suffering, and you get liberation. So bhakti also does that, but it's a little bit, it does it in a different way. It is much easier, and we get a different result also. Klesha refers to suffering. So suffering, of course, we get sickness or accidents, whatever. That is the final result. But there's a cause of that. And the cause is karma. We do certain activities So we get bad results and suffering if we do sinful activities from a previous life. We get some nice results if we do punyas, pious activities in a previous life. So the cause of our suffering or enjoyment now is a result of previous sinful actions, papa. But these actions were caused by desires. Huh? So desires lead to action, the action leads to karma, the karma leads to the suffering. But what is the sort, why do we have these desires? So the origin of the desire is avidya, ignorance. Okay? We're completely ignorant of who we are. We don't know, we think we're the material body, we don't know we're atma. We don't know that we're the servant of Krishna. So that ignorance is there. That causes us to develop desires for enjoyment for ourselves. Consequently, we do actions, then we get our karma. So the suffering is in a chain like this, from avidya to the seed of papa, or the seed of sin, that's called desires, and then the papa, that's the sin. We do the action, and then we get the karma, the suffering. So all of these are destroyed by the process of bhakti. The suffering that we're having, behind that the desires, behind that the avidya. Yeah. So that avidya is, we have our sense of I am a certain person, and then we identify with the body through ahankara, and then we develop a desire to enjoy. We like something, we hate something, we fear something, we destroy something, we do all our activities. And then we get bodies in the material world as a result of our action, like that. Huh? Okay, anyway, so, for instance, we're put in a certain circumstance, we get angry, or somebody gets angry at us and he hits us or whatever, we get angry at him, we hit another guy, like that. So because of that, we hit it, we do an action that causes suffering to another person, then we get a karma, we may die, and get born, we may get the karma in the next lifetime, or the next life, or the next lifetime, some future lifetime, we get the ultimate result that we get some suffering back on ourselves. Yeah? So we do suffering to another person, we get suffering back on ourselves. But not just human beings, we can do suffering, give suffering to an animal, and we'll get some suffering in a future life also. So the final suffering is the result of that previous karma. So even there, it's a little bit complex. It doesn't manifest immediately. It may manifest 5 lifetimes later, 10 lifetimes later, whatever. And we can't tell when the particular karma is going to manifest. But they're all waiting for us. So at any one time, we have the karmas of this lifetime to go through, which are waiting in our subtle body. But then we have piles of other karmas that are waiting for future lifetimes also. And we're also committing more karmas now. More activities, and creating more future karmas. So it's very difficult to get rid of all of our karmas because we're constantly accruing new karmas and we've got backloads of other karmas. So difficult to get out of the situation. So karma yoga just makes a little adjustment by doing punyas to counteract the bad ones, and we get a little relief in this world. But we don't get out of the material world. So jnana and yoga, well, they try to destroy all the karmas, but so many karmas are there from previous lifetimes, and so piles are there, plus we're making karmas in this lifetime. So difficult to get rid of the karmas. So that's why it takes jnana and yoga process a very, very long time to get mukti. Because it takes so long to destroy all your karmas. So the karmas are measured, or they're given in Nectar Devotion, 4 stages, the completely invisible ones that we don't know about now, and we may not even know next lifetime or next life or next lifetime. They're completely untraceable, but they're there. And one day they will manifest. Okay? Then we have the ones called kuta, which are slightly a little more gross. They're coming up in a future lifetime. But maybe you can detect them a little if you had a vision or a dream about a future lifetime and a future play. That would be your karma, your kuta manifesting some lifetime and an event of a future lifetime or something. Then, in this lifetime, then we have abhija. Abhija is a little more gross because it's going to happen in this lifetime, but it hasn't happened yet. And we may get a dream about it. People have premonitions sometimes. I'm going to have an accident on that day or whatever, or a dream or whatever. So that's a the bija. It's getting a little more gross, but it hasn't manifested yet. Then we have the actual prarabdha experience of a karma, sickness, accident, loss of money, whatever. That's the prarabdha. So the last two are what takes place in this lifetime, the subtle aspect and the gross aspect. The others are future lifetimes, invisible and slightly visible. But all of these stages are destroyed by the process of bhakti. So this is a little bit different from jnana and yoga. They don't claim to destroy your karmas of this lifetime, the bija and the prarabdha. They won't destroy that. They'll start destroying the kuta and the aparabdha, future lifetime. So after you die, you can get your liberation. But they say the karmas of this lifetime, you have to experience them. But bhakti, it destroys even the karmas of this lifetime. The example is given in the Bhagavatam, and it's quoted in Nectar Devotion, of the dog-eater. So a dog-eater is a dog-eater because he's in a position very low in society because of his karma. He's lower than a sudra. It's not even a varnashram system. So he's there by bad karma. But if that dog-eater performs bhakti, such as chanting the holy name of the Lord or meditating the lotus feet of the Lord, immediately he is qualified to do what a brahmana can do, which means suddenly all of his karmas of this lifetime are gone. He's no longer a chandala or a dog eater. Suddenly he's qualified to do what a brahmana can do. So that means the prarabdha karmas, the karmas of this lifetime, can completely dissipate. Karma and jnana do not claim that at all. But bhakti will say, even the prarabdha karmas, the karmas of this lifetime are destroyed by the process of bhakti. And therefore, the devotee is beyond the brahmana. That, of course, is why we also, in our second initiation, we get a brahman thread. Just to show that if you're an initiated Vaishnava, that means that you've destroyed all your karmas. So you're no longer a matsya or a sudra or whatever. You're superior to a brahmana. So therefore, Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati gave the Gayatri mantra and the thread to show that we're equal and superior to the brahmana. So anyway, the prarabdha karmas are destroyed by the process of bhakti. Like that. So therefore, all the stages of the karma are destroyed, from the invisible to the visible, plus the seed of the karmas, that is the desire, that's also destroyed. And finally, the avidya, the ahankara and avidya, they're destroyed also. And when that is gone, then what manifests is bhava. When we get to that stage, we practice bhakti and destroy all these things, we get to bhava. So, as we go through our performance of bhakti, we destroy the prarabdha, the bija, the kuta, and then finally the aparabdha. And then we also destroy, this is the karmas, and then we also destroy the seed of sin and the ignorance, the avidya. And we go from bhava and then we get to prema. So these two, the second quality is called subhada. The first one is destruction of all suffering, karma, ignorance. The second one is manifesting auspiciousness, manifesting good qualities. First one is destroying the bad things, and the second one is gaining the good things. So both of these manifest within sadhana, begin to get manifested within sadhana bhakti. In other words, you can destroy all the karmas, as even Ajamil, he didn't even do bhakti and destroyed all of his karmas by just chanting the name of Narayana. So not so difficult to destroy karmas in bhakti. Very difficult in jnana and yoga. So that's unique to bhakti. So the second quality is the positive aspect, not just destruction of bad things, but bestowal of good qualities. Rupa Goswami analyzed his jagat prinan, affection for all living entities. The devotee develops compassion for all beings, and therefore he doesn't want to commit violence against any living entity. Jagatam anurakta, attractive to all living entities. The other beings, other humans, they begin to recognize the wonderful qualities of the devotee, so they worship him and they respect him. Sadguna, developing good qualities. Other different qualities can be manifest in the devotee. like. Krishna has all wonderful qualities, mentioned in the southern section of Nectar Devotion, 64 qualities. So if one is a devotee of the Lord, one will start developing at least 50 of those qualities, and maybe up to 55 of those qualities. Both will develop in the devotee also. So we associate with the Lord, we develop qualities like the Lord. So these are not material qualities. They are not sattvic qualities. They are transcendental qualities, spiritual qualities, like the Lord's qualities. So these all begin to manifest also within the jiva as he performs bhakti. So not completely manifest in sadhana. Some is going to manifest. We got start from maybe 1% and we get it to 5%, 20%, 50%, 70%, 80% in bhava maybe. And then prema, perfection. All wonderful qualities, no bad qualities, no karma at all. So these things happen simultaneously. Destruction of karmas and anarthas, etc. And manifestation of wonderful spiritual qualities of the devotee. Another explanation of this is sukha, that the devotee, bestowal of auspiciousness, the devotee develops happiness. He doesn't want material happiness, bhoga, because that will mix his bhakti. He doesn't want liberation, that will also create mixed bhakti, gyan misra bhakti. He gets happiness from bhakti itself, satisfaction. We don't call it ananda here, because ananda only manifests when we directly perceive the Lord in bhava and prema. But even before that, we get some sort of satisfaction from the process of bhakti, so we call it bhakti sukha. That turns into ananda in bhava, it becomes a very intense ananda in prema. Very intense bliss in prema. So these are the first two qualities to manifest in the jiva. So these are not qualities that are just something in your mind or whatever. They're actually, they manifest because the jiva is developing bhakti. So, if one comes to the stage of bhava, then two other qualities manifest. One is moksha laguta kriti, disinterest in the bliss of liberation. Liberation will give you peace, destruction of karmas, no more material body, no suffering. So it's a type of bliss. But the devotee in bhava has a realization of the Lord, and he feels bliss in that relationship, that rasa, and therefore the bliss of liberation, the absence of suffering, is insignificant. This is quite unlike the bliss of the jnani and the yogi. They strive for liberation and that peaceful situation beyond the gunas. The devotees say, we don't want that. We only want prema. So this is one quality of bhakti which is quite distinct from the jnanis and the yogis, distinct. Another quality of bhava is sudurlabha, rarely attained. So to realize the Lord is rare. The jnani and the yogi cannot realize the Lord. So they can't get bhava. Bhava is the first realization of the Lord. The jnani and the yogi can't get that. So in that sense, bhava, bhakti is very, very rare. However, the devotee can attain it, but he doesn't get it immediately also. So he has to go through stages. So he goes through anarcha nirvritti, nishta, ruchi, and then asakti, and then he gets bhava. So he has to follow a certain process to get, which takes some time, to get to the bhava stage and realization of the Lord. So he can't ask for it immediately. In that sense, it's rare for the devotee. But nevertheless, if the devotee practices uttama bhakti or pure bhakti, he can get to the bhava. And the jnani and the yogi, they cannot get it at all. So in that sense, it is rare. So, in prema, two qualities manifest. One is sandarananda visheshatma, condensed bliss, composed of hladini and sanvit shaktis of the Lord. So this is also impossible to attain for the jnani and the yogi because they don't even realize the Lord, what to speak of developing a relationship of prema. So this is not just bliss, but intense bliss. In bhava one gets bliss, and in prema one gets intense bliss. So this is one unique quality of prema, like that. So we get bhava stage, Brahman, we get this absence of suffering, this little gray thing down there. Bhava, we get bliss, ananda, relationship with the Lord. But then in prema, there's extraordinary bliss, even beyond the bhava stage. So it's incomparable and indescribable bliss in prema, which is inconceivable to jnanis and yogis. So the last quality that manifests in prema is Krishna Akarshani. It attracts Krishna. It controls Krishna. Prema controls Krishna. So this is very unique. The jnani and the yogi can't even see Krishna. It's described in Brahma Samhita that the yogi may be able to see one ray from the toenail of Krishna. One ray of Brahman from the toenail of Krishna. That's the extent that the yogi can get, and he gets a little peace that way. What to speak of seeing Krishna in his full form? What to speak of controlling Krishna? He can't do that at all. But the devotee not only sees Krishna, Krishna actually serves the devotee. So this is very, very rare. Not available to jnanis, yogis, karmis, or anyone else. Only to the devotee who gets to prema. It's not even available to the mixed devotees. Only those who practice pure devotees can get prema. The mixed devotees, they get up to salokya sarasti, but again, they don't control Krishna. But these devotees who practice pure bhakti will be able to control Krishna. Krishna will serve those devotees. So this is the last characteristic. Two of the qualities manifesting in sadhana, that is destruction of karmas and kleshas, suffering, ignorance, desires, etc. And bestowal of good qualities. It starts in sadhana. It's not complete, but it starts there. In bhav bhakti, we get two qualities. That is this dismissal of liberation as insignificant and rare, rarely achieved. Something that not everybody gets. And then the third stage, prema, gives two qualities, condensed bliss, and it controls Krishna. So there we get six unique qualities of bhakti. So in sadhana, the two manifest. In bhava, those two manifest more, plus we get the two extra qualities. And in prema, two more qualities. So in prema, we get all six qualities manifesting in full. So we get the qualities of sadhana bhakti, that is the destruction of all kleshas and bestowal of good qualities that manifests fully in prema. And then the qualities in bhava, the disregard for liberation and the rarity continue. And then we get the two extra qualities. So prema manifests all six qualities. And these are unique qualities of bhakti which will never be available to other processes. So Rupa Goswami ends this section with a little bit of explanation that you can understand about bhakti what is written in the Nectar of Devotion, not by material logic or tarka, argumentation, but by a taste for bhakti. We have to have a taste, then we can begin to understand these subjects. So, if we have a little taste, we can understand. Doesn't mean we have to have full taste in Ruchi stage. We can, even if we're doing the beginning of sadhana, if we have a favorable attitude towards Krishna, then we can begin to understand a little bit. But if we try to understand the process by dry logic and by jnana, etc., then we won't be able to. So, he says that logic is insubstantial. That means that whatever is established by logic as a conclusion will later be disproved by another person who's more intelligent. He will use logic and he will say that's not correct, and he will defeat you and he will make a new conclusion. Then later on a more intelligent person will come along and he will defeat that other person with his intelligence, like this. So in this way logic is insubstantial. It's an infinite process of one person defeating another person in the material world, but there's no end to it. So, in this way, logic is not helpful to us. However, That does not mean that we discharge logic and we only irrationally explain things to people. That also doesn't work. So we can use logic, and we should use logic, but it follows after the scriptures, not independent of bhakti, not independent of scriptures. So if we do bhakti, we can also use logic. So very nicely we can understand the stages of bhakti and the performance of bhakti, and we can explain that to another person using logic, using reason. There's no harm in doing that. And in fact, later on, it's described that a person with uttama faith, the best type of faith in sadhana bhakti, vaidhi sadhana bhakti, is the person who not only knows scripture, but very logically he can analyze it and he can explain it to another person. So he's considered to be the uttama devotee. So therefore logic is not discarded. We use it, but we don't use it independently of the process of bhakti to analyze it and tear it apart or defeat it or anything like that. And we use it to understand it properly. So therefore logic is also useful to us. Okay, that covers the section there. Thank you. Any questions?
Process of shadows of praying, you have a mountain of vritti, things in the heart of wanted things. But at the same time, sometimes it's said that when you get initiated, the spiritual master takes all your karma. So how does those two things
So one way of explaining that is that in the scriptures they're sometimes speaking of a different condition. When we come to the holy name, it's a little different because we can start the holy name without initiation and even accidentally. You can destroy your karmas like Ajamil without doing any bhakti at all just by uttering accidentally the name of Narayan, etc. So in previous ages, they relied not on the holy name but on bhakti in general and particularly deity worship. But you couldn't get deity worship unless you came to a certain standard first. And to do the deity worship, then you had to take the initiation to get the mantras to worship the deity. So initiation was the qualification to begin the process of bhakti. So in that sense, we could say that after initiation, then you destroy your karmas through the mercy of the guru, etc. So that's one way of explaining it. The other is that what that means is that not that the guru is suddenly destroying all your karmas because you've already done some bhakti and chanted the holy name and whatever, that destroys your karmas also. Rather, that he's responsible for your future actions because he's taken a responsibility for you, just as a teacher, any teacher takes responsibility for the student, or the husband takes responsibility for the wife, or the king takes responsibility for the citizens. And if the dependent does a sinful activity, the person responsible has to share the result. So that the person bears the result, the responsible person bears the result of the other person's activities like that. So in that sense, the guru is responsible for the karmas of the disciple. He accepts their karmas or whatever like that. So that's another way of looking at it. But then again, we shouldn't think that then we're free to do anything we want to once we're initiated, because yes, the guru may get some result, but doesn't get completely. We're never free of our responsibility as a jiva. So, yes, the guru's got partial responsibility, but not complete. So we do have our responsibility also there.
And also,
Prabhupada
said that when you
the cycle of karma
from upper object through to prabhupada. So I guess there's an element of free will in that. When that karma on the prabhupada stage that sort of manifests, but how we deal with it is sort of like have free will in one sense. But I'm just wondering, through astrology, does astrology show up these different aspects of karma?
Well, technically for the devotee like Ajamil, he's accidentally chanted the name with no offense and all of his karmas, past, present, future, were destroyed. So that Yamaraj couldn't even touch him because there were no karmas there at all. And that's accidental bhakti, not even intentional bhakti. So if we do intentional bhakti, then we should also not have any karmas. But Ajamil had no karmas because he had no aparads. So therefore, he went away like that. So if you do have some upper rods in this lifetime or past lifetimes, that can slow down the process of getting rid of all your karmas and your whatever. So we may still have some karmas left even if we do practice bhakti, because the influence of upper rod is slowing the process to some degree.
So the jhana, he maintained himself through stealing and that sort of thing, but that's not...
It wasn't upper rod. It was sinful activity, but not upper rod against the Lord. So he never ever thought badly of the Lord or insulted the devotees or did anything like that. So
sinful activity and upper rod is
different. Yeah, different results. Yeah. So therefore the karmas are slowed down to some degree if we have upper rods from previous lifetime or this lifetime, and then we have to get the result of that. So those will be detectable by astrology or whatever. But even if you have prema and your karmas are all destroyed at that point, and even in by the bhava stage they should be destroyed also, Krishna keeps a pattern there anyway. A pattern of karma there. And you do have a material body, which is also karma. So if you had all your karmas destroyed at bhava stage, you would disappear. Your body would disappear because your karmas would be ended. You would die as soon as you got to bhava stage because all your karmas would be gone, including your body. But obviously the Lord doesn't do that. So he keeps your body there. And then the body has to survive in the material world. It may get sick, you may have an accident or whatever. So it looks like karma also, but it's actually the Lord's control, the Lord's pattern of karma, not karma's karma. So it's under the Lord at that point. And he gives a little pattern there, which may be detectable by astrology also, but it's not real karma because it's under the Lord. At any point, he can just remove all that if he wants to.
Sometimes the early devotees couldn't understand why karma's apparently suffering.
Yeah. Yes, the will of the Lord.
Bhagavatam Upanishad refers to the lifetime of devotional service. This is done to perform devotional service to one lifetime, and Prabhupada mentions it a few times. Do you think that lifetime refers to the physical lifetime, or then refer to the lifetime from Shraddha Brahma?
Well, I think if we take it literally, it means I've never thought of thinking it that way. Shraddha to Prema, a lifetime in that sense. Usually we take it in direct meaning of lifetime. But we also see that most people are going to take longer than that, many lifetimes. So we see the example of Bharat. He was in the line from Manu, so he was actually a very exalted person, you know, empowered. He's there, vibhutis of the Lord, empowered by the Lord to rule the world. And then he retired. And then he got to bhava stage. But then next lifetime he became a deer. Next lifetime he became a human. And then he got prema. So from bhava to prema was three lifetimes. What to speak of many lifetimes to get to bhava stage also. So that's the case of Bharat, who was a very exalted person. So what to speak of us, you know, it's going to maybe take longer than that. Longer than three lifetimes from bhava to prema. We don't even get to bhava, so it's going to take a few lifetimes to get to bhava also. But nothing is impossible. So it can happen in one lifetime. And that's the case of Ajamil. He was completely unqualified. Then he heard the Yamadutas and the Vishnudutas discussing, and then he became attracted to bhakti. Then he came back to life by the mercy of the Vishnudutas and Vishnu, and then he began to practice bhakti with the devotees. And then in that same lifetime he got to Vaikuntha. So he got prema in one lifetime also. So it's possible, but usually it seems to take longer than that.
It seems like when the devotee gets particular stage, it doesn't really matter anymore because it's like saying, we don't need some cake, but how do you get there? Well, you need cake. Just keep eating cake until you get to the cake.
Yeah. But actually, like the higher you get, then the less you are concerned about that. You just pray, let me birth after birth be born in a family of devotees. That's all we care about. We don't want to, that doesn't matter when we get there at all. Let me be born 1,000, but somehow I get the mercy of the Lord. So that's the attitude of the devotee. He doesn't care how many lifetimes it takes him to get to the Lord.
You mentioned Nivasi is an instant karma and will be ordered to Vaikuntha.
Yeah, you get Salokya and Sarupya.
So the You mentioned that they meditate on the Lord, but they don't do much service.
Yeah.
I'm wondering what else would they do then if they're not doing service?
Well, they enjoy very nicely. They got a nice palace, they got servants, they can manifest anything with their mind, etc. So they engage themselves very nicely, like a very rich man, you know, in his house, and he doesn't have to work, so he just can do anything he wants, you know. So like that. They do have a relationship with the Lord, because obviously in spiritual world there must be some relationship with the Lord to get there. But you can say it's a very weak form of relationship of rasa, like a shanta rasa. So one of the shanta rasa is called neutral. They don't actively serve the Lord. They just kind of appreciate very nicely. So that's shanta rasa. So this is like a weak form of that. That's what they get. So they're very satisfied. And they can sometimes see the Lord, and they appreciate the form of the Lord, but they're also kind of, you know, not so much into actively serving. The relationship is a little less intense. But it's certainly superior to this person in Brahman who doesn't even see the Lord, who's just, I exist. I'm beyond the material world. That's his only consciousness. But this person actually has a consciousness of the Lord, but the relationship is weak, so therefore he's satisfied with meditating on the Lord and appreciating him.
Is it possible to make progress from that point?
Well, generally they don't. Can we progress from Shanta to Dasya or Dasya to Sakya? If that were so, then ultimately everybody would be in Madhurya Rasa with Krishna. And the Vaikuntha and other places would be empty. So generally they stick to their own, whatever they attain, that's their treasured relationship. They prefer that over anything else once they get it. So those people who develop Sakya, they stay in Sakya with the Lord. Those who are Dasya, they stay in Dasya. Those who are with Vishnu, stay with Vishnu. Those who attain Rama are with Rama. They don't aspire for anything else.
The high bhakti defined as continuous service or emotions directed towards Krishna. His expansion. Expansion forms or others related to him.
Yeah.
With pleasing attitude towards him.
Yeah.
I think everyone was asking Prabhupada about Krishna, and he said, I something on the lines of, I don't know Krishna, but I know my spiritual master.
This is much. Yeah. So that's why it says there, persons related to the Lord. That means the devotees. So later on, Rupa Goswami says all these angas of bhakti, like hearing, chanting, remembering, worship, etc., relate to the Lord. But it also relates to the devotees of the Lord. So you can glorify the Lord, the servants of the Lord, the devotees of the Lord. You can serve them in various ways. So that's also part of uttama bhakti. So therefore, of course, obviously we relate to the devotees and hear from the devotees and serve the devotees and glorify the devotees, etc. This is also part of uttama bhakti. Okay.
Can you tell us what that picture is doing?
Oh, that was just, I put it, the waves. I had a whole series of waves for the ocean of nectar. So I had somebody, there was a whole file of wave pictures, so I just put a wave at the end here.
I can't look it
up. No, I don't know how it's orange, but it's an orange wave. Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu, part of the ocean. Okay, Hare Krishna.